for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, and with a live 24-hour-a-day, 7-day dedicated radio stream at whiterosesociety.org. Yep, it's the Tom Hartman channel. You can listen to the most recent program anytime, 24/7 live, over at whiterosesociety.org. You can find it from tomhartman.com. Just click listen live. It'll get you there. And, of course, there's archives going back for, at least a year, maybe two, on White Rose Society. Perhaps even longer than that. I believe it's pretty much the whole history of the show. And American FM on Live 365. Anyhow, you get it. Here we are. Welcome to the program. The bill, this is the Bankruptcy Slavery Act. Democrats.com has an interesting op-ed piece on this. They say this bill is a Republican payback to MBNA. I told you yesterday about sitting next to a guy who worked for a credit card company on an airplane. Not necessarily this company, but in any case, the bill is a Republican payback to MBNA, America's largest credit card company and the single largest contributor to the Republican Party. Interesting little factoid. Paul Krugman calls this the Debt Peonage Society, as in peons, as in feudalism, something I've been talking about for 2 years here. Jacob Hacker, he says, a political scientist at Yale, calls risk privatization. This is the conservative agenda. He calls it risk privatization. In other words, what we've done over the last 80 years or so in the United States in particular, although arguably what we've done since the founding of this country, is to take the most severe of our risks, for example, the risk of drinking water and dying because it's contaminated, the risk of not having enough food, the risk of not having common places, common spaces, parks, you know, roads, that we've taken those risks and we've publicized rather than privatized them. In other words, we've said, we the people, we're going to take responsibility for these risks. We're going to handle this stuff. And one of those risks is the risk of having half of all elderly people living in such poverty that many of them are dying literally of starvation, as was the case in the 1930s. And the risk of children whose parents die in some god-awful accident or car, house fire or whatever, providing for them. And the risk of adults who are injured in such a way that they can't ever work again, break their neck, break their back, whatever, providing for them. That what we've done is we've said, okay, collectively, we're going to take on some of those risks. And the Republican agenda, or at least the conservative agenda, there's a few Democrats signed on for this as well, they're reversing this and they're privatizing those risks. In other words, they're saying it's an ownership society. You own the risks. They're yours. Society is no longer going to handle these risks. We're going to reduce taxes on the rich and increase risks for the poor. Very simple, very straightforward. And that's the bottom line of this bankruptcy bill. And as Paul Krugman points out in his column in the New York Times yesterday, more than half of bankruptcies are the result of medical emergencies. The rest are overwhelmingly the result of either job loss, a little bit of that been going on lately, or divorce. And this is mostly women, single women. Suddenly, you know, they weren't in the workplace. It's very difficult to find a decent job now. Their husband leaves them. They have debt. Boom. He does point out that there is a lot of abuse of the bankruptcy system, but the abuse is by the wealthy. There's this little trick called an asset protection trust that if you've got assets worth over $1 million or so, you can hire a CPA and a lawyer to put one of these things together. It's rather expensive, but it'll shelter millions. And if you have an asset protection trust, then you can declare bankruptcy and hang on to your money. You can only do it, though, if you're a millionaire. So Charles Schumer, the senator from the Democrat from New York State, introduced an amendment that would have limited the exemption on such trusts. Not eliminated it, just limited it. The Republicans, 54 Republicans, 2 Democrats. No way! What, are you kidding? Eliminate protections for rich people? Ted Kennedy introduced an exemption, says Paul Krugman. I pointed this out yesterday, by the way, but it's worth repeating. For cases of medical bankruptcy, Russ Feingold introduced an amendment protecting the homes of the elderly. Dick Durbin asked for protection for armed services members and veterans. All were rejected by the Republican majority. So what I encourage you to do is to contact your member of Congress. Now, clearly, you know, the senators, your Senate, there's going to be a vote on this in the Senate either today or tomorrow. And so I would encourage you to contact your member of the Senate, the United States Senate, or to contact your member of Congress. Now, there's funny laws about it, largely as a result of shock jocks abusing, you know, calling up people and they're not knowing that they're on the air and all that. And so you've got to notify people that you're on the air. So I, you know, we have a regular relationship with Bernie Sanders' office that I don't have with Jim Jeffords and Pat Leahy, my senator. So we're going to call our congressman. I'm just going to role model this for you and give an example of how it works. Okay, so we're going to call Congressman Sanders' office. Whoops. Oh, there we go. And we'll just see how this works. One ringy dingy. Two ringy dingies.
Congressman Sanders' office.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman calling. May I speak with whoever's in charge of the bankruptcy bill and issues thereof?
Hold on.
By the way, the number for Congress, 202-224-3121. You can call any member of the House or Senate. 202-224-3121. And just a simple phone call away. 14 minutes past the hour. This is the Tom Hartman radio program.
Hello, this is Joel Barkin.
Hello, Joel. You're on the staff of Congressman Sanders.
Yes, that's correct.
This is Tom Hartman calling. We are on the air, and you know about our show, so it's, we can. But nonetheless, if I'm calling you as a constituent, not as a talk show host, I'm really concerned about this bankruptcy bill, and I wanted to know, how can I register my concern with your office?
Well, by calling.
Which I've just done.
Right now is registering your concern, obviously.
Okay.
And
what generally happens when people call a member of Congress and they talk to one of the staff people like yourself?
Well, what we try to do is find out immediately what the issue is that people are concerned with. And I'll be very honest, the most effective way to contact your member is to contact the one who represents you.
Right. And you guys represent
our office, so. Always gives sort of preferential treatment to Vermonters.
Just yeah. Yeah. This is why I suggested to my listeners that they call 202-224-3121, which is the main switchboard
right.
for Congress, and they can get That's routed right. to their member of Congress. So call the person who represents you and then tell them, and like I'm telling you, hey, I think this bankruptcy bill is basically protection from the rich for the rich. They've got these asset protection trusts that they're going to keep intact. And screw the little guy. And I'm outraged, and I want to see it voted down. Now it's going to be up for a vote today or tomorrow in the Senate. You're with the House.
Right.
Bernie's with the House of Representatives. But do you folks talk with the senators from Vermont as well? Is this the congressional?
All the time.
Okay.
We are in constant contact, not only with the senators in Vermont, but other like-minded senators over in that body.
Okay.
So we work closely with members of the Senate, and we certainly will share our concerns over this bill. And we have been sharing our concerns, and the more calls we get, the more sort of ammunition we have to go in with.
Right, and that's true of every member of Congress. So people all across the United States right now could be calling 202-224-3121 and asking for their member of, actually, ideally, their senator. Because
right.
this bill right now is before the Senate, although in a matter of months, if it passes the Senate, it's going to be in your lap. It's going to be in the House
That's
of
right.
Representatives. And
That's right.
We get to repeat the song and dance. So there's nothing wrong with calling your congressman right now, too, and they'll pass along the word. And so you'll pass along the word for me, Joel?
I will, 100%.
Great. Thanks a lot. Good talking
Thank
with you,
Tom.
Joel.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, that's how you do it, folks. It's that simple. I'm telling you, you call 202-224-3121, talk to your member of Congress or your, if you don't know, that's fine. Call that number and say, hi, I'm from Iowa. I'm not sure who my senators are. Can you please tell me? And they'll tell you. And you say, well, I'd like to speak to one of them, and then they'll connect you to them. And then when you're done, call back and say, I'd like to speak to the other one. And, of course, you're not going to get through to the actual member, odds are, unless you're a major donor or a big corporation. Although, you know, there are a few who you can get through. Dennis Kucinich, Bernie Sanders, there's a few who are more responsive to the people than the businesses. But by and large, you will get through to the staff, and the staff actually do keep track of this stuff. They actually do keep track of this stuff. Yesterday, well, day before yesterday, actually, was Louise's birthday. And she says, you don't tell people how old women are. Okay, I won't. We've been married 33 years. You can do the math. Anyway, yesterday was Louise's birthday, day before yesterday. And she claims that I'm always traveling on her birthday. And it's not true. I'm not always traveling on it. I've had over the years a very heavy travel schedule, and there have been days when I have been gone, I confess. And I was this week. I was flying home from San Diego. So last night we went out to dinner and a movie for her birthday, and I have kind of a standing rule. I don't do sad movies. I'm sorry. There's enough tragedy in the world and in my life. And I don't mean that in any kind of martyr way, but, you know, I mean, everybody, that I don't need it inflicted on me in a movie. And I'm not a real fan of just grossly violent movies. So Louise said there's this movie, The Aquatic Life, with Bill Murray in it, that would be a funny movie. And so we went to see this thing, and we sat through it for 2 hours, and I am still totally baffled. What was this movie about? I don't have a clue. So if you know, give me a call. Our number, 866-889-8894. And by the way, our chat room is live and open and full of folks. And Harriet there says, happy birthday, Louise. I just passed it along for you, Harriet. And you can drop in. Just go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat if you want to get into that. But what is this movie, The Aquatic Life? I couldn't figure out. I sat there for 120 minutes, 2 hours, and I still have no idea what this is about. Anyhow, I want to move along from that as well. Interesting story about President Bush, dubbed Walking Eagle by Native Americans. It's apparently an apocryphal story, but nonetheless a fun and interesting one. We'll get back to that right after this. Lots in the news, by the way. A lot in the news. I want to get into Social Security. I want to get into what's going on in Taiwan, China, the Republic of China. Just some fascinating, concerning, alarming issues. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Our chat room has a whole bunch of theories. One is that it was a pastiche on the Jacques Cousteau movies, none of which I've seen, so I saw them on TV a few times, I suppose, but maybe not. Who knows? Speaking of water, big discussion now, water movies. I liked Waterworld, that dippy movie with Kevin Costner in it, where he played the guy with the webbed finger. You know, it was post-global warming. I thought, actually, there was this one moment in the movie where he's standing in front of a picture of, was it Joseph Hazelwood, the skipper of the Exxon Valdez? You know, and they're all paying homage to this guy. But I date myself. Let's take a couple calls, then I'll tell you about Walking Eagle, and we'll move along with a few other things, as it were. Paul in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Tom. I wanted to quickly run by something. Bush just had a big foreign policy speech about 2 hours ago.
I didn't see it. I missed it.
Primarily on the Middle East, and it's something I normally could never get more than 20 or 30 seconds through. But what I did was, ahead of time, I wrote down a bunch of words and see how many times he used each word, and then would mark. And I picked some words such as liberty, justice, freedom, democracy, terror, tyranny, and a bunch of words. And it's interesting. It came down into three different groupings, the most words he used most often.
Interesting.
Freedom and free, you know, sort of the same, came in number one at 33. Then right behind it was terror, terrorist, tyranny at 32. So those were the top two, freedom and terror.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then the next grouping, which was a little below, security, he used 16 times, and the word democracy 15 times, about tied.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another grouping below that. Courage, he used 10 times, and then 9/11 or a reference to 9/11 came in 10. So it's interesting. Courage and 9/11 were sort of used the exact same time. Security and democracy was the next grouping at about 16. But by far the most commonly used words were freedom and free and terror and terrorist words. So it was interesting just to do that. That's the only way I could probably listen to a whole speech of this.
Yeah, these guys are very sophisticated at this. I mean, remember his speech at
the
Republican National Convention. Here it is.
Arrive on a quiet morning, the evil terrorists. September the 11th, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid, evil. The world will drift toward tragedy.
It just went on like that. I mean, I've got 2 minutes of it here, doing the same thing that you did, only on audio.
It's interesting, words he didn't use, I had like justice, he used justice once.
Uh-huh.
And liberty three times, and rights or human rights twice. So there are words he didn't use very often at all.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Well, they do this stuff, this is well planned.
Hold us back. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Afghanistan, terror.
Yeah, anyway, it's on and on and on and on it goes. Paul, thanks for sharing that with us. That's absolutely fascinating. You ought to write a little op-ed piece about that and get it out there on the web or something. And are you listening on KRSN, by the way, in Sunday?
Actually, I'm on Sirius right now.
Ah, okay. Great. Well, we're on the air on KRSN. I believe it's 1490, as I recall, in Santa Fe, just starting this week. So glad to be back in that market. Paul, thanks for the call. And good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. He's still going.
Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, the evil terrorists, radical ideology of hate, kill the innocent, and they should be afraid. Be afraid. Tyranny and
terror.
So
this is the old, scare people hard enough, and they'll do anything.
The resurrection, tyranny, God, the resurrection, God.
Remarkable. Anyhow, President Bush was invited to address a major gathering of American Indian Nation peoples last weekend in Arizona, or so goes the story floating around the Internet. Share some of the details of this with you. Yes, it's an apocryphal story, but nonetheless, it's interesting. 29 minutes past the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Night. 27 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Why are they claiming 14th Amendment rights against discrimination to be able to force themselves on communities? Well, that's something for you and I, we the people, to take up. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
I was listening to Glenn Beck this morning. And
you have my sympathy, Tony.
Oh, I know. He was having people call their congressmen to push for this Terry's Law, habeas corpus reform. on the grounds that habeas corpus is something that's for death row inmates to take their case to a different court, or for convicts to take their case to a different court.
Wait a second. You're talking about habeas corpus, the thing that started in the year 1215 with Articles 38 and 39 of the Magna Carta?
Which gives us all our trial rights.
That's right. He wants to do away with this. It's in, it's the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th amendments of the Constitution, by the way.
He wants to reform it. But he was telling
reform it! You, excuse me.
I know, exactly. Don't let the Republicans at habeas corpus.
Jeez. This is outrageous. I mean, you know, habeas corpus was so well enshrined by 1815 that when the British arrested Napoleon and they wanted to exile him to this island off the coast of Greece or wherever it was, they had to pass a special law called, and it was called a law for the confinement of Napoleon Bonaparte. They had to pass a special law suspending habeas corpus for this one guy. Because, you know, there was this principle, there's been this principle in law since the Magna Carta. And then, you know, again in the 1627, I believe it was, King Charles I sued five knights on a tax case. And the people rose up and Parliament rose up and they passed the Magna Carta, or not the Magna Carta, the Habeas Corpus Act of 1627. And then there was another one in 1649. There's been a whole series of laws. I mean, this is nothing. This is not something some liberal thought up last week. We're talking about the core, the beating heart of human rights is habeas corpus, which, for those who don't know, is Latin for produce the body. And it literally means you have the right to face your accuser. You have the right to a trial by jury. You have the right to be accused of a crime. And the government has no right to hold you without at least accusing you of a crime, giving you an opportunity to make bail if appropriate, unless you're such a threat to society that it can be proved that you're a threat to society, that there's no bail, and the right to face your accuser and the right to counsel on your behalf, even if you can't afford it.
And he said that habeas corpus is pretty much just for death row inmates to take their case to a different court.
Well, if I find it hard to believe that Glenn Beck would be that stupid. I think he's a pretty smart guy. I know.
You know, he is a smart guy, and I know he's just deceiving people.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
And I encourage everyone to call their senators and tell them to leave it alone.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. So now you got two things to call you. Now you have two things to call your senators about today. Number one, you know, habeas corpus is something we value. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And number two, stop this insane bankruptcy bill. If you're a Democrat, filibuster it. If you're a Republican, get some spine and stand up to the credit card companies and speak out on behalf of your constituents. We the people, the number in Congress, 202-224-3121. Tony, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
great
no
to
problem.
Hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to comment on that last a couple callers back on Bush's speech, overly using the word freedom and free. Because
yeah.
I was thinking about this morning when I was hearing that, and I'm thinking, well, he's been doing this a lot lately. It's got to be a Frank Luntz, you know, calculated strategy.
Oh, they have carefully focus grouped these words.
I know, and what I'm thinking how they do this a lot is they use freedom to really mean freedom from regulations, freedom from rules. Because, again, they conflate democracy and capitalism, and they want to mean, you know, don't regulate the corporations. So they never use democracy, justice, fairness. They use
human
that
rights.
Less than the word, this nebulous term, freedom.
Right. They don't talk about human rights, for
no.
example. They don't talk about the rights of individuals in a society. They don't talk about the rights of preventing oppression from, as Franklin Roosevelt said, government or the well-heeled alike.
Yeah, this is all calculated using this nebulous term, freedom. And I heard a guy, a talk show host, Dennis Prager, conservative Jewish guy who has a talk show out of L.A., and he's given speeches to Congress about this, using the term freedom, free markets. Just keep hammering that word freedom. Don't say democracy, we the people, for the people, right?
Yeah.
And, again, like Frank Luntz said, don't say government. Say the word Washington, because that's nebulous. Washington means 50-50 Democrats, Republicans, to deflect responsibility on who really is controlling Washington, right? We should say Republican Congress in Washington, who controls everything.
Right, as the Republicans did so effectively when the Democrats controlled Congress.
Well, they used to say Democratic Wars.
Democratic
Wars, Republican
Democratic Congress.
Great Depression. Always when you say Great Depression, put the word Republican in front of it.
Yeah, well, you know, to some extent, Tom, I do those things, and to some extent, I'm just really not into psychological warfare. But I agree with you that we do need to very clearly and efficiently frame these things. Got to move along. Mark in Woodlawn, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know what I'm really worried about? I'm really worried about Bush putting the term limits. I think he wants to do away with term limits and go again for another 4 years. I'm really worried about that.
Well, it's going to require an amendment to the Constitution, so it's not going to happen. You can relax, Mark. Constitutional amendments are really hard things to get through. There's been over 19,700 of them proposed since the United States started, and only about 30 of them have passed. You have to have two-thirds vote in the House and Senate, plus three-quarters of the states have to ratify them. It's not going to happen in time for Georgia W.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you set me aside on that.
Yeah, so you can sleep well, Mark. Thanks for the call, though. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Pivot in Atlanta's on the line. Hey, Pivot.
Hi, Tom. Hey, you've read the book Natural Capitalism, Natural Capitalism by Paul Harkin.
I have. Yeah, and I know Paul. Yes.
Oh, great. Because I have read your book, The Last Days of Ancient Sunlight. I know you're obviously the type of person who realizes there's a lot of potential for us to really fix things, but you know, until people actually read books like that, whether it be the government or business leaders, my point is that I feel like shows like yours, all we're doing is talking about the problem and the fact that the government is corrupt. Every day we just keep talking about the problem. I realize it's important to stay informed.
Actually, I'm trying to focus very much, Pivot, on the solutions. That's why I'm asking people to call your members of Congress today.
I still feel like it's such a waste of time, especially with this particular administration. I feel like what we need to do is sort of adopt more libertarian principles and get people like Oprah or other leaders of the community who have money and clout and say, you know, we can enact
Hang on just a second. So, Pivot, you're saying the libertarian principles. In other words, the rich are going to be our salvation?
No, I didn't mean it like that. When I say libertarian principles, I mean the part of that libertarian principle that says we don't need the government. But I don't.
Did you go to public school?
Yeah, look, I'm trying to find a balance between the two, is what I'm trying to suggest.
Okay,
I definitely have problems with a lot of libertarian principles. But I guess what I'm trying to say is if we had honest people with a conscience, like Oprah, who were leading us to consolidate our resources and implement all of the principles in natural capitalism, then I think we could make a big headway into, like, you know, an example that Ted Kennedy gave, which he didn't refer to natural capitalism, but he said with Medicare, we could save $115 billion if we put all the paperwork into computers.
Yeah, you know? and simply consolidate it all in one place, which is what Medicare has done, basically. Medicare Medicare runs on an overhead of 1%, by the way. Private health insurance in the United States, private for-profit health insurance, which the libertarians love because it's run by corporations instead of the government, typical overhead somewhere between 15 and 27%. So, you know, I'm sorry. I am not looking to the rich or Oprah or anybody else. God bless her. She's great. But I'm not looking to them for our salvation, Pivot. I'm saying you and me, we have to get active. We have to be writing letters to the editor. We have to be contacting our newspaper. You know, the Burlington Free Press, the local Gannett paper here in Vermont that blankets the state, they have been so right wing. Every month or so, I fire off an email to the guy who's the editorial page editor. I don't know him. I've never met him, but I got his name. It's on their website. And he occasionally answers me. And so, you know, I'm pushing for change here. It's what we all need to be doing. Alan in St. Louis on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Yes, yesterday I was talking to a relative of mine in Alabama, and
yes,
he was saying that he was supporting Judge Roy Moore, and he went to a meeting where they're trying to get him to run for governor.
Yes, you can expect that guy to be running for something. That's what this has been all about right from the very get-go.
Yeah, and this relative of mine, he doesn't seem like a religious person. But when I told him that I didn't want a religious type of a government, he said that the reason why he's supporting Roy Moore is because of the Muslims are taking over the world. So it's really a religion of fear, it sounded like to me.
Yeah. It's our religion versus their religion, and this has not been lost on Bush. I pointed out in this piece I wrote for Common Dreams a couple of weeks ago what Hitler said about the Jews is not all that different. There are obviously many differences, but it's not all that different from the fear mongering that's going on about Muslims right now in the United States. The vast majority of Muslims have have no interest in Osama bin Laden. And to the extent that they do, to a large extent, it's because of our policies. We're driving them in that direction.
Yeah, and like the callers before, it seemed like it's just a politics and religion of fear.
Yeah. Yeah, there's
not religion at all to me.
There you go. That's fear is not what Jesus came to preach, and it's not what Moses was preaching, and it's not what had a nice long list. I would say it's not even what Muhammad was preaching. Certainly, it isn't the core of Islam. It isn't the core of Buddhism. It isn't the core of Hinduism. In all of those religions, what you find at their core is love and peace. That hippie liberal stuff. Liz in Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just thought anybody contacting their representative about habeas corpus might like to know that a line of Supreme Court decisions came down in the 80s and the 90s, which created a doctrine known as abuse of the writ that prevents duplicative or successive petitions under habeas corpus for criminals. And that doctrine was ratified and further extended by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996.
Right. Now, let me translate this into English, Liz, for our listeners. What Liz just said is that these guys who are pushing this habeas corpus suspension stuff, you know, let's do away with our rights. They're doing it because they say, oh, these people in prison, they're filing lawsuit after lawsuit and tying up the courts and making it a big mess. And what Liz just pointed out is, no, in fact, the Supreme Court ruled you can't do that. That's called abusive process. You can't do that. The courts just throw these things out. They ignore them. It's not tying up our courts. If anything, what's tying up our courts are lawsuits by big corporations against little people who dare speak out against them.
That's right.
So, okay. What good point made, Liz. Well made, too. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Bill in New York City or New York State there, Bill?
New York City. I have a suggestion about the Bush meetings when he has these town hall meetings where they're only exempt to certain people on the list.
Yeah.
I think that maybe we should have senators, congressmen, aldermen, anybody who is who can show up who's from government with guests, and then possibly when these people are turned away, it might focus media attention on what he's doing.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing. This is from the Washington Post. I don't know if you caught this, Bill. From an article, let's see, WashingtonPost.com. Anyhow, I've been writing a lot lately about the audiences of Bush's conversations about Social Security are screened of dissenters. In Newsweek, Holly Bailey, Richard Wolf, and Tamara Lipper write in Newsweek, and this is on the Newsweek website, the audiences are actually full of ringers. And now, quoting from Newsweek, the White House likes to call them regular folks, people with real-life questions about the president's agenda. Only some are more regular than others. Carlos Huertas was billed as a concerned grandfather and hardworking engineer when he sat on stage next to President Bush to talk about retirement accounts in downtown Tampa, Florida last month. But, Newsweek reports, the Florida granddad is an activist for Freedom Works, a conservative group founded by former vice presidential nominee Jack Kemp and Dick Armey, the former House GOP leader. Freedom Works, I'm still quoting from Newsweek, Freedom Work officials tell Newsweek they have worked closely with the administration to coordinate the town halls, often suggesting names of the people on stage. At least five of its activists have appeared with Bush, and the group has bussed hundreds to eight of his events in recent weeks. By the group's own tally, at least one-third of the audience in Tampa, Florida, when George Bush sat there in his town hall meeting with regular folks, one-third of the audience were members of this right-wing group, Freedom Works. And you go to their website, which is CSE.org, and Matt Kibb enthuses about their accomplishments. He says, donning pro-reform stickers and T-shirts, activists from North Carolina boarded a charter bus to travel to Washington, forming part of an 80-person Freedom Works contingent at the event. This is one of George Bush's gigs, you know. Right. Even better, two Freedom Works members discussed Social Security reform on stage with President Bush. Oh, they're so proud of themselves. Freedom Works presence was not limited to Washington, D.C. As the president tours the nation, Freedom Works is there at every turn in the president's schedule. Our members are there to enthusiastically cheer President Bush and his plan to save Social Security. So it's not just handpicked people. It's not just people who agree with him. It's not just people who vote Republican. They're ringers. They got a bunch of Jeff Gannons in there. It's ringers. It's even worse than you think, Bill. But thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. I appreciate it. Matt in Kansas is on the line. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It does make a difference when you do contact congressmen and senators. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I know you're overwhelmed with correspondence, but I sent you a quote from Senator Barry Goldwater.
Yes.
Warning Republicans and other Americans about about absolute power. I've been concerned about this. I never in my lifetime have I seen a movement like this neoconservative movement that wants to absolutely control everything.
Yeah, and fact, let me just share with folks your quote that you sent me. This is from Senator Barry Goldwater, one-time presidential candidate, a guy that I actually went door-to-door for in 1964 when I was 13 years old. Those who seek absolute power, even though they seek to do what they regard as good, are simply demanding the right to enforce their own version of heaven on earth. They are the very ones who almost always create the most hellish tyrannies. Absolute power does corrupt, and those who seek it must be suspect. Their mistaken course stems from false, and then he goes on and on about this. But he's absolutely right. And, Matt, thanks for sending that to me. I appreciate it. I've been meaning to use it as my quote today for some time.
I actually have heard back from a few senators, believe it or not.
Yeah, they will contact you. You've got to be calling your member of Congress. Do it today. Stop the bankruptcy bill 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Here's the story of a corporation that has newspapers in every place you go.
Uh-oh.
It also owns a couple cable stations, a movie studio.
Oh, who could that be?
And there was another corporation.
Oh, no.
One day these corporate giants formed a merger. Not even dinner.
Oh, yes, it's AOL Time Warner.
AOL Time Warner. Broadcasting all the news upon the air.
Oh, my. AOL Time Warner. Somebody wrote a song about that. That's amazing.
Witness all their monumental power.
Yes, welcome back. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. I think our Walking Eagle story is going to have to move into the next hour. The phones just don't stop here. Ron in Tucson on the line. Hey, Ron, what's up?
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
My problem is this. If you try writing to Jim Colby or John Kyle,
yeah,
guess what you get?
You get a form letter back.
You get a standard Republican rhetoric.
Yeah.
There is no thought about what you're saying.
I understand that, Ron, and I agree with you.
It's just totally frustrating. That's why people give up.
I know. But they still notice the fact that you have contacted them. And if enough people contact them who disagree with them, it may cause them to reconsider their positions. And that's why it's so important that you do it.
Tom, the attitude today expressed by these people is that the people with money and power in corporate America support us. You are a peon. You go to work every day. We don't have to listen to you because you know what? You people can't outvote us.
And the only thing that allows them to maintain that mindset, Ron, is the fact that the average American isn't contacting them. And so you've got to get in touch with them. I'm telling you, you got to do it. Amy in San Diego on the line. And thanks for the call, Ron. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I was one of the people at your seminar this weekend in San Diego, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
But what I wanted to talk to you about today was I'm just confused on how the Constitution actually works. I know that one guy called in, and he said that he was afraid Bush was going to run again, and you said, you know, it takes a constitutional amendment.
Right.
But they do lots of things against the Constitution without amendments, like, you know, holding these people in Guantanamo without...
That's clearly unconstitutional, Amy, and I'm expecting that, you know, sometime soon that stuff all going to get overturned. But after Franklin Roosevelt won four terms, mm-hmm. the Republicans got together and during the Eisenhower administration, as I recall, pushed through an actual amendment to the Constitution saying nobody can run for president more than twice, or you can't serve more than two terms as president. And that is so unambiguous that, you know, it's not... They're not gonna trample that the way they've trampled habeas corpus. They just won't be able to get away with it and say, oh, the only way that they could get away with it is declare a state of emergency, which I wouldn't put it past them, and say, oh, we've got terrorists, we've got to halt the elections. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix of Right-Wing Talk Radio. Are we left-wing talk radio? I don't think so. I think this is the radical middle, my friends. This is where most of America hangs out. Most of America would really like clean air. You know, the current law says that by 2008, mercury emissions have to be down to 5 tons. Now, that's enough to contaminate about 900 million children, but nonetheless, down to 5 tons from our nuclear power plant, or from our coal-fired and oil-fired power plants. But Bush wants to raise that to 20 tons, and he calls that the Clear Skies Initiative. I don't think it's a leftist policy to say, stop poisoning our children. But the cons would like you to think it's a leftist policy.
How dare he? Our great leader has said it's Clear Skies Initiative.
Yes, it means a little more mercury in the air, but it's more profitable for the big power and oil companies who contribute to the politicians. Speaking of politicians, this story, I've got five different people have emailed this thing to me, so I just had to, I'm assuming that you've gotten it in email, because it is one of those things just going around. First of all, it reminds me of the old joke, and this is one from when I was a kid, where this is like from the 1800s, right? This joke goes back that far, where the politician, and I hope this is not too politically incorrect, right? It doesn't sound like I'm, screw it, I'll tell it anyway. That a politician shows up at a Native American community out west someplace, and he says, and if you vote for me, there'll be two squaws in every teepee, and everybody goes, Ungoa! And he says, two chickens in every pot, and everybody goes, Ungoa! And we'll make sure that, you know, your lands will be protected forever, and they're all going, Ungoa! He's feeling pretty good, you know, every time he makes a promise, you know, they all yell, Ungoa! Finally, when he's all done, he's getting ready to leave, and he's not sure where they tied up his horse, and so he goes over to one of the Indians there, and he says, where are the horses? Where's my horse tied up? And the guy says, oh, he's around the corner there, just behind those trees in that pasture. Just be careful you don't step in any Ungoa. So, anyhow, that's not the one that's flying around the Internet. This is the one that's flying around the Internet. President Bush was invited to address a major gathering of the American Indian Nation last weekend in Arizona. He spoke for almost an hour on his future plans for increasing every Native American's present standard of living. He referred to his career as governor of Texas, how he had signed yes 1,237 times for every Indian issue that came to his desk for approval. Although the president was vague on the details of his plan, he seemed most enthusiastic about his future ideas for helping his, quote, red brothers, end quote. At the conclusion of his speech, the tribes presented the president with a plaque inscribed with his new Indian name, Walking Eagle. The proud president then departed in his motorcade, waving to the crowds. A news reporter later inquired to the group of chiefs, how had they come to select the new name given to the president? They explained that Walking Eagle is the name given to a bird so full of, so full that it can't fly, so full of,
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the,
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse. Yes. Per every day, and by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of,
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 and 3, you've got a pile of this,
excrement.
Yeah.
So full of it, the Walking Eagle can no longer fly. And it's probably an apocryphal story. According to one of the web sources, it is. But it's a great story, nonetheless. So here we have now Alan Greenspan, who for so long, Democrats and Republicans have both behaved as if they respected this guy. Which has baffled me for decades, because he doesn't try to hide the fact that back in the 50s or early 60s that Ayn Rand initiated him in her apartment in New York City into her cult. Her cult of the objectivists. He doesn't try to hide the fact that he believes that there should not be any Social Security, that people should stand on their own 2 feet. And if a child's parents die, well, that's tough. There should be relatives who will take care of them. And people shouldn't move away from where their families are. Or they should be there to protect. Basically living in the 18th century. And he makes no bones about it. Should be fewer taxes on the rich, heavier taxes on the poor. He's told the Wall Street Journal back in 97 that he feels that one important part of his job description is to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity, to use Greenspan's phrase, so that there will not be, quote, wage inflation, end quote. Now, it's okay if CEO wages inflate. And they have exploded, actually. But if the average worker's wages inflate, then Greenspan has a problem. But now, people are starting to figure it out, or at least the Democrats are. It took them a while. Sometimes you wonder. Hear this from the International Herald Tribune, an article by Brian Knowlton. Dateline Washington, Alan Greenspan, long considered above partisan reproach. So this is, why do people say this of him? I mean, the guy is a right-wing hack. Okay, there's right. You've got Zell Miller and in the Democratic Party. I suppose there's some right-wing and Joe Lieberman. You got some right-wingers in the Democratic Party. So I suppose you could say he's transpartisan. But Anyway, Alan Greenspan, long considered above partisan reproach, is a celebrated steward of the U.S. economy. Yes, right. He drives down interest rates for 3 years in a row to levels we haven't seen since just after World War II, when we were trying to put the country back together. Why? So that George W. Bush can get actually elected in 2004. And in the process, he creates a massive housing bubble. He drives housing prices out of the reach of so many Americans. Well, wait a minute, you say. More Americans own their homes now than ever before. True. True. But wait until interest rates go back up to just normal levels. I mean, just where they should be relative to inflation. You're going to see bankruptcies and a housing bubble crash. I've lived through this. We saw the same thing back in the 70s. Nixon tried this same little trick, and it was a disaster. Anyhow, long considered above partisan reproach as a celebrated steward of the U.S. economy. Encountered criticism Sunday from Democratic lawmakers who said he had gone too far in support of Bush administration ideas on tax cuts, the notion of a consumption-based tax, and Social Security reform. Finally, the Democrats are waking up to who Alan Greenspan really is and what he's all about. Why didn't they just read what he said? I mean, he's been saying it for 40 years, for goodness sake. Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, Mr. Brian Knowlton, had made a, quote, grievous error, end quote, in endorsing George W. Bush's tax cuts that have, quote, driven us into the worst deficit situation we have ever seen in this country, end quote, said Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the Assistant Democratic Floor Leader. Well, Senator Durbin, congratulations on waking up. Now, I shouldn't be sarcastic. It's entirely possible that Dick Durbin has known this all along. I don't know. Hopefully. Harry Reid now is starting to wake up. Durkin's comment on NBC television came 3 days after a pointed attack by the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid of Nevada, who called Greenspan, quote, one of the biggest political hacks we have here in Washington, end quote. Harry Reid, even though I'm not a Democrat, and even though I think you're a wimp on a lot of issues, I salute you for having the courage to speak up and call Greenspan a political hack. It would have been considered heresy during the Clinton administration when Clinton was sucking up to Greenspan. And now Nancy Pelosi, she goes on Fox TV last Sunday, and she says, these statements made by the distinguished chairman of the Fed See, she's still trying to play polite, right? These statements made by the distinguished chairman of the Fed question the independence of the Fed. Now, this is something new? They're just figuring this out? Now, at the same time, by the way, we're going to get to this in a minute. Today is Worldwide Women's Day. I want to be sure and mention that. We will be getting, in fact, I had intended to get to in the first hour. We just got buried, but we will come back to that in just a moment. Warren Buffett, but I want to just finish up this kind of economic stuff here. Warren Buffett, one of the world's most successful investors, and by the way, one of America's richest men, has launched his most withering attack to date. This from Simon Bowers in The Guardian, the UK. The U.S. trade deficit, describing Americans as, quote, rich spending junkies, end quote, who could turn our nation, the United States, into a nation of, quote, sharecroppers. Well, you know, I hate to go up against Warren Buffett. I have a tremendous respect for Warren Buffett. But I really think that to some extent here, he's blaming the victim for having worn a short skirt and thus gotten raped. It's not the American people who are rich spending junkies. It is the policies of the conservative administrations that have run this nation into debt. It is the trade policies of both the Reagan, the Bush, the Clinton, and the Bush administrations, all four of them, that have hollowed out the industrial core of America. Now, I mean, even our defense industry is owned by, increasingly, by foreign companies. Anyhow, in his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway, which is his investment group, it's like $10,000 to buy a share in this company, you know. Mr. Buffett painted a bleak picture of a future U.S. in which ownership and wealth had continued to move overseas, leaving the economy in thrall to foreign interests and faced with financial turmoil and political unrest. He's talking about the trade deficit. See, we have two deficits. There's the trade deficit. That's the amount of stuff we buy versus what we sell overseas. It's about $600 billion this last year. And then we have the budget deficit, which is officially around $400 billion, but is actually about $600 and something billion because Bush spent $200 billion of the Social Security surplus this year so that his budget deficit numbers wouldn't look so bad. Just looking at the trade deficit, Buffett says this force feeding of American wealth to the rest of the world is now proceeding at the rate of $1.8 billion a day. And what is the rest of the wealth doing, or the rest of the world doing with this wealth? They're buying our companies. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Good old Neil Young. Welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. Transforming the world. Literally the world. By revitalizing democracy. That's what we are doing, my friends. Because the world, at least until George W. Bush came along, the world looked to the United States as a role model, as an example of how people could live together, how you could have a pluralistic society, how you could have an open and transparent government, how corrupt officials got brought down and hoisted on their own petard, as Richard Nixon was, how people were held accountable for their actions, even actions as minute as having a little fun with an intern in the White House. The world used to look to us and say, we'd like to have a government just like theirs. And once again, someday, it will. Once again, the world will look to us. Trust me, it is coming. I believe it. I really and truly believe it. These things move in cycles. The United States has had bad times before. We have had bad leaders before. We have gone backwards before. We have had demagogues on the radio. Look at Father Coughlin. I mean, you know, it's happened before. It'll happen again. But before we get into that rant, let's listen to speaking of rants, hey, Ellen Ratner.
A piece of Father Coughlin trivia.
Okay.
How many secretaries did Father Coughlin have in the late 30s, early 40s to answer his email? I mean, his snail mail, his regular mail.
That's a good question. I don't know, but I know he had 40 million listeners, which makes
70 full-time secretaries.
Wow. Yeah, he was a phenomenon. I mean, you know, he originally supported Roosevelt. Many argued that he helped bring him to power, and then he hated Roosevelt toward the end, and they finally had to retire him because of his anti-Semitic rants. He went over the edge. I think he was getting Alzheimer's or something. But interesting, 75 full time. Wow. So what's happening, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service?
Okay.
What's happening
in
Washington, D.C.?
The big news in town today is that, and we heard the same old from the White House, no big news, but two interesting things that the Democrats say they're going to do. One is Nancy Pelosi and Louise Slaughter of New York released a report today in which they said that because of the Rules Committee in the House, and every bill, for your listeners that don't understand, that goes through the House has to go through the Rules Committee, where they decide how the bill is going to go through legislation. And they have all these days of bills called suspension of the rules, where there aren't the regular rules for debate, et cetera. And what they're saying is, first of all, that the number of days of suspension of the rules is increasing so that there isn't time for real debate on issues. Two, over 900 bills have been passed in the 108th Congress under suspension of the rules. And thirdly, when they get conference bills, such as these omnibus bills or other kinds of bills that come out of conference, some of these huge bills, they have had an average of 44 seconds per page to look at what is in this legislation as to when it comes out of the Rules Committee and when it is voted on the floor, and that the rules are designed to minimize any real amendments or any real debate, so that you have essentially a one-party system in Congress. And they have, it's on Louise Slaughter's webpage. You can download it, Tom. It's a really interesting report.
Is that slaughter.house.gov? Would that be slaughter.house.gov?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you go to thomas.house.gov or whatever, you know, and then you just look up her thing, and it's on her webpage.
Right.
It is really an amazing report, and their press conference today really outlined what is going on in the House of Representatives to make sure that it is not a representative house.
I will have to look for that, because these guys, it's very clear that the only way that they think they can hold on to power is by creating a single-party state, just as Mussolini did. It's got to be a one-party state.
Well, they're clearly doing that, and the report will make your hair stand on end.
Amazing. Okay, I'll check it out. We'll share it with our listeners tomorrow. Ellen, thanks so much. You're
always very well.
Bring us just the greatest information. The Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner, thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
No, we're never going back again. We're not going back to that. To Bush world here. People are starting to figure it out. You know, it's really quite remarkable. People are starting to realize that, you know, what our grandparents knew, and I'd say most of our parents knew, that the grand old party, and even the conservatives among the Democrats, is the party of, as Thomas Jefferson said, of the Federalists imploded, became the Whigs imploded, became the Republicans. As Thomas Jefferson said of them, the party of the rich and the well-born. Today is International Women's Day. Dion Harrison in the San Francisco Chronicle notes, 10 years ago, a landmark UN conference in Beijing adopted a platform seeking to establish global equality for women. Well, turns out that's something the Bush administration's not very happy about. The platform states women should be able to, quote, decide freely and responsibly on matters related to their sexuality, free of coercion, discrimination, and violence. It also asserts that abortion should be safe in those places where it's legal. And in those places where it's illegal, criminal charges should not be filed against the women who undergo illegal abortion, but rather against the abortionists. More than 100 countries came together, 6,000 advocates on February 28th for a follow-up meeting at that conference. Review the progress of the women's rights. They were going to talk about women in politics, political participation. They were going to talk about trafficking in women for sex around the world, sexual slavery. They were going to talk about women's issues regarding HIV/AIDS. Instead, they had to spend all their time talking about the Bush administration because the U.S. delegation would not sign on to this statement of seeking to establish global equality for women because they don't believe women should be guaranteed the right to abortion. This despite the fact that the platform does not guarantee abortion rights, notes Diane Harrison in the San Francisco Chronicle. She goes on to say the U.S. delegation was also concerned that the ability, quote, to decide freely and responsibly on matters related to their sexuality free of coercion, discrimination, and violence, end quote, constitutes what the Bush administration calls sexual rights for women, end quote. Which, according to the chief of the United States delegation, quote, not all member states accept, end quote. You get this? This is outrageous. Diane Harrison points out in the San Francisco Chronicle, Ethiopia is a perfect example. Women have few rights. Laws and traditions prevent them from owning property, so they remain dependent on husbands and sons. In some instances, girls as young as 9 are married off to older men. According to the United Nations Women's Watch, most Ethiopian women have their first child by 17 and are prevented from pursuing an education there, you know, thereby. 75% of women in Ethiopia are illiterate. Only 8% of women in Ethiopia have access to contraception. They have little or no control over when or whether they will have sex and repeatedly face unplanned pregnancies. They bear on average 7 children. Their maternal mortality rate is among the worst in the world, and rates of sexually transmitted infections are extremely high. The World Bank reports that more than 2 million women in Ethiopia have HIV/AIDS. These rates, Diane Harrison notes, are worsening because of the Bush administration's position on women. In 2001, President Bush reinstated the global gag rule restricting funding for family planning. All because not all member states accept that women have sexual rights. So today, International Women's Day, and in this country, we should be wearing a black armband to memorialize the tragedy of this administration's response to it. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, I was listening in the last half hour to your discussion about Alan Greenspan.
Yes, sir.
And I know you know this. Maybe some of the listeners don't, but he's a disciple of Ayn Rand, you know, the...
Yeah, I pointed it out that he had been inducted into her cult in her apartment in New York City back in the 50s.
Right. But I don't know if you ever discussed this on your program or not. You know, there are some folks on the left and the right that don't even think that the Federal Reserve System is constitutional. In other words, the Constitution specifically says that only Congress has the right to print and coin money. And what we have now is kind of a double system where the Congress gets involved with fiscal issues. You know, they call it fiscal policy as far as appropriating money and how much they spend, et cetera. And then, of course, the Federal Reserve System under the guidance of Mr. Greenspan or whoever is the chairman has to do with the actual money supply. And I wondered if you ever discussed that, if you have any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I have, and I've read rather extensively on it. And you know, there was... Although I don't pretend to be an expert on it.
No.
I believe, wasn't there an amendment to the Constitution that brought the Fed into being or that allowed for that to happen? And everybody's saying that it didn't pass by one state failed to ratify it, and that's why it's illegal, and that's the whole
Well,
yeah, gotcha hook.
I think you might be confusing because about the same time the income tax came into effect.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I'm mixing
somebody
the income
said
tax
it wasn't constitutional
yeah,
because
you're
Ohio
right.
ratified it, and through some technicality,
yeah.
Ohio didn't really become a state until 1953 or something.
Yeah,
but,
you're right.
But I think the Federal Reserve is probably something like the wars that have been fought since December 8th of 1941. I mean, wars have been fought by this country without a formal declaration of war since December 8th of 41. We haven't declared war since then, but it's become policy. And
yeah, we never declared war in Korea. We never declared
right.
war in Vietnam. We never declared war in Grenada, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And the Congress yeah. has acquiesced in this, and I think probably yeah. the same thing is true of the Federal Reserve. It probably is unconstitutional, but if nobody does anything about it, it's going to continue to exist. You know,
well, and I believe it's a federally chartered corporation to some extent. Now, the reality is, though, the Fed is owned by its member banks, and its member
right.
banks are owned by, it's owned by the, what is it, 9 federal banks, or are there 12? There's a certain number of federal regional banks, right? The one closest to me here is in Boston. And that bank is owned by its member banks. So, for example, Chittenden Bank, the bank here in Montpelier that is a member of the Federal Reserve banking system, if you buy stock in Chittenden Bank, you're, you know, indirectly 2 steps away buying stock in the Federal Reserve system. And like you said, Congress reserves the sole right to mint money, and it's kind of a hybrid system. I mean, prior to that, you had the state. This is the battle that's been going on ever since the founding of this country, because Alexander Hamilton wanted to have a central bank, and Jefferson didn't want there to be one, and this is a big battle, and
right.
And then the first bank of the U.S. went bankrupt. What in the 1820s, as I recall, the second bank of the United States went bankrupt in Philadelphia in the 1840s, and that led to the Great Depression, that led to the Civil War. Some would say.
Well, without getting too conspiratorial here, Andrew Jackson was the last president under whose administration we had zero debt, and I mean zero, not just for that year, but you know.
Yeah, and Jackson was elected on a platform of doing away with the national bank.
The first attempted assassination attempt was on Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
Now, Abraham Lincoln, I believe, did something, I forget exactly what he did, to thwart the banking system.
Yeah.
He was assassinated. President Kennedy wanted to print currency that was backed by gold rather than the Fed. And
right, because Nixon had taken us off the gold standard.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole body of conspiracy theory stuff around this and a whole body of, you know, probably very legitimate concerns about the Fed. And I don't dismiss any of it. The reality, however, though, Rick, is that we have this system that we have right now. And I think that we need to be, to the extent that the Fed chairman is appointed, I believe, by the president and ratified by Congress, that we need to be holding the administration accountable and our members of Congress accountable for at least the Fed chairman. I'm not sure how the individual governors are appointed, because there is, you know, there's also this with the Board of Governors, and there's a vote there. So I'll have to do some reading up, Rick. And if you've got some good information on it, you want to pass it along to me, drop me an email. So,
okay, I was just going to say, though, that the Federal Reserve chairman, just like the attorney general or anybody else that's appointed by the president, is actually supposed to look after the welfare of the people of this country, theoretically, not just the president.
Right, and Greenspan has really seen his job not looking after the welfare of the people of the country, but looking after the welfare of the most wealthy and the powerful and the corporations of this country. And he's pretty unambiguous about it.
Oh, sure.
Rick, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Bob in Michigan on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have been talking to people for years about how the Republican Party has spent us into debt. I've used probably every kind of explanation that I can humanly think of to bring it to their attention and draw it out of their mind so that they can, this has happened. And I have literally run into a blank wall, a brick wall, and I just don't know what to say next to these people and how to bring them to the realization that their so-called conservative party is "quote unquote," the liberal party that they call the Democrats.
Yeah, well, it's neither conservative nor liberal, because deficit spending is not a conservative or a liberal position. But you're absolutely right. I was amazed during the presidential debates when George W. Bush made fun of John Kerry for saying that we should have pay as you go. In other words, that we should only spend money that we actually have. And he made fun of John Kerry for that, implying that, you know, it's fine to borrow and spend. And, you know, they used to call these guys tax and spend Democrats. Well, yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. You tax and before you spend. And now what we have are borrow and spend Republicans, and they've mortgaged our children's future and our grandchildren's future, for that matter. Just George W. Bush's tax cuts for the rich, just that alone, that contribution to our deficit over the 75-year event horizon that they're using to project Social Security, that will produce $11 trillion in shortfalls. Social Security over those 75 years will produce about $3.6 trillion in shortfalls. Where is the real crisis?
Yeah, exactly. The real crisis is in the fact that we've got a conservative party in this country that just loves to spend it, and it happened under Reagan and George H., and now it's happening under George W.
And Bill Clinton kicked in a little bit there, too, and let us not forget it, Bob.
He kicked in a little bit, but look at how he left.
Yeah, he left us with surpluses, and to some extent, see, this is I'll give Bill Clinton some credit for that. I think we also need to give the Republicans some credit for that. I think that what happened during the Clinton administration was you had two parties competing with each other in power. I mean, you had the White House in the Democratic hands, and you had Congress in the Republican hands, and that dynamic tension is a good and healthy thing for democracy. The Republicans are running around saying they're responsible for the balanced budget. Clinton's running around saying he's responsible for the balanced budget. I would say the fact that you had two parties fighting with each other is what was responsible for the balanced budget, and the fact that we have single-party rule now in the Supreme Court, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House is a huge problem. It was a problem under Roosevelt as well, I would suggest. I just don't think that one party should control all four branches of government, or all three branches, all four parts of the three branches of government. And that's what's happened. Bob, I got to move along. Thanks for raising it.
You have a good day, Tom.
You too. Excellent point you raised, and I do appreciate it. Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I emailed you about this. When I was sworn into the service and took my oath as a Marine, and any veteran can identify with this, I was sworn to protect the Constitution of the United States of America. And somehow
that's the oath of office. That's also the oath of office that the president takes.
Yes.
He's not sworn to protect democracy or. Yeah.
But the thing is, I've emailed you about this idea. Perhaps it is too premature in history for this, but I just saw a news story on Somalia where the government is too scared to return the duly appointed government of Somalia from the anarchy there. The warlords still rule there, but they have a government in exile in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened, I think, now in the United States, I believe we need a peacefully minded evolutionary government, not revolutionary, not military-minded, government in exile.
Yeah, well, along those same lines, Brian, and I don't disagree, although I would fine-tune it a little bit. In many countries, and I may be wrong, I think they do this in Australia. Maybe they even do it in Canada. And I'm displaying my ignorance of some of these nations that I've spent
India
a lot of time
does it
in.
Too.
India, yeah, they have actual shadow governments.
They do for Tibet.
Yeah, okay.
India.
So the party that is out of power organize, and I think they do in the UK too. They organize. They have their own Secretary of State and their own Secretary of Defense, and the people aren't real. They don't really have any power, but they speak as if. As you know, this is what I would do if I had the power, right?
Yeah.
And so you get a sense of what that party would be up to, rather than just, you know, carping on and picking on people. And I think the Democratic Party, if they want a strategy, if Howard Dean wants a strategy of something to do, that would be a brilliant one. And Brian, you've nailed it. It's excellent. I don't think it should be, you know, a government in exile. I think that sounds a little too far out. But I think a shadow government, having a shadow government and say a shadow cabinet, it's a great idea. And it's not a new, original, or radical idea. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Xavier.
Hi, good morning, Tom.
What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to shift the conversation back to that article you read about Women's Day.
Yes, International Women's Day today.
I think that's a great idea. And
what's a great idea?
Well, the working on women's issues. But I also want to. This is. I'm the guy who calls in and, you know, says this is great, but I'm not detracting from that. I don't want to take the wind out of the sails of that. That thrust to try to do that. But my concern is there are a couple issues I'm thinking of. One is women who choose to be sex workers and mail order brides, women who choose to do this sort of thing, maybe to upgrade their they're
well, in a lot of countries, those things are legal. In Germany, prostitution was legalized a couple of years ago. It's,
right.
It's,
well, I guess what I'm trying to say,
in the Netherlands,
though,
it's been legal for decades. This is, you know.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say, though, is this is part and parcel of improving women's lots, is dividing oppression, real oppression of women, from things that women choose to do.
Yeah,
and,
I don't disagree with you at all, Xavier. I spot on and well said. But the reality is that in those societies where women have equal power with men, population stabilizes. In those societies where women are bought and sold like cattle, population explodes. The key to the population explosion, which is one of the driving forces that are destroying this planet, is women's rights. It's just a...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the billionaires for Bush and Cheney. And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Lori in Michigan on the line. Hey, Lori.
Hi.
What's up?
I was just calling to let you know that according to CTR at calltorenewal.org, there's an 800 number that people can call to let their local representatives and senators know that they oppose the budget. And I suppose that they could also let their views be known on the bankruptcy bill and habeas corpus also.
Okay. Although, you know, I can... Are you talking about local officials or national officials?
Well, it would be their state senators and representatives for their voting area. And they'll even let you know who those people are.
Okay. So that would be the local officials.
Yes.
Okay. And do you have that phone number?
Yes. It's 800-247-2971.
Why don't you say it one more time?
1-800-247-2971.
Great. Lori, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate
uh-huh.
it.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. And hopefully she didn't, Lori is not a trickster just putting out the number of Jeff Gannon's escort service. Louise comes in and during the break and points out, you know, it's... prostitution is very often exploitative of women. I absolutely agree. And Jeff Gannon decided to become a prostitute. Sometimes men do it too. These are tough issues. But this is International Women's Day, and it's you know, it's very different. I remember the first time Louise and I were in Europe, this 25 years ago or so, longer than that actually. And we were in Amsterdam in Holland, and we were walking down the street where they've got the women's in the windows, you know, and one of them was, one of the window was open. It was a nice summer day, and she called out to us and yelled something to me like, you know, hey, good looking, you know, you want to come up for a good day. And I said, I'm with my wife. And she says, that's fine. You can both come up. And Louise still chuckles about that one. And no, we didn't say fine. We kept on walking. But they have health care, and they, you know, they get regularly tested, and they're very into safe sex and all this kind of, and that, in my opinion, is not so much the, but what we have to recognize is that there is this massive trade. I mean, one of the major dimensions of slavery in the world is mostly young women being sold as sex slaves, mostly in the third world. And this is an issue that the United Nations and the world body are trying to address, and the Bush administration is stopping them from even having a discussion about it for fear that they may say that women have, quote, sexual rights, end quote. I mean, how dare they? It's another reason to get politically involved and do it now. It's the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Tom Hartman here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it looks like we've handed them so much of our wealth, so much of our money, so many of our resources, so many trillions of our dollars. The Chinese, the communist Chinese, the anti-democratic, autocratic, murder their own people, throw people in jail for exercising freedom of religion, throw people in jail for trying to form a union Chinese. Our conservative economic policies have given them so much money and so much power and have given them so much technology. Now that we can't build an aircraft carrier without parts from China, that they have finally reached a point where they've said, okay, the United States, you guys think you're tough? We're tougher. In regard specifically to Taiwan. Taiwan, of course, an island, used to be called Formosa. In 1544, it was stumbled upon by Portuguese explorers and named Ilha Formosa, the beautiful island in Portuguese. The Dutch showed up there in 1624. The Spanish showed up there in 1626. The Dutch kicked the Spanish out in 1642. And, of course, on it goes. But really, the history, I remember, we've been to Taiwan. I've been there a number of times. The last time I was there with Louise and our youngest daughter, Kareth, who was homeschooling at the time. So she was traveling with us wherever we went, and we were traveling around the world. We stopped in Taiwan. It was the week of the elections. This was 9 years ago, thereabouts, something like that. It was many years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, whenever the election cycle before. And I remember Kareth to this day has a hard time looking at hard-boiled eggs, I think. They have this delicacy called thousand-year-old eggs, and you walk into, like, the equivalent of a 7-Eleven. Every store had them, and you can smell them as soon as you walk in. And they're like these hard-boiled eggs that are soaked in something for some incredibly long period of time, like weeks. And they smell rotted. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. And it's a delicacy, and people buy them and munch on them. And after a while, she couldn't even walk into those stores. The smell got to her. But yeah, cultural things. I know I have a good friend who's Japanese, who one time described to me, we were having dinner together, and it was pizza. I had a pizza. And he was looking at it with this, what are you eating look on his face. I said, what's the matter? And he said, well, that stuff on top of the pizza. And I said, yeah, the cheese. And he said, well, you call it cheese. He said, I would call it putrefied mammary secretions from a large mammal. And as you can guess, cheese is not very popular in Japan, which might be why they have such a low heart attack rate. In any case, in 1945, Japan let go of their control of Taiwan. General Chiang Kai-shek, who at that time was, in tight with the Chinese, appointed General Chen Yi to take over Taiwan. At that time, there were 6,700,000 indigenous Taiwanese and a couple hundred thousand Japanese civilians and military personnel. By a year later, they had kicked out 90% of the Japanese. In 1947, the Chinese took it over. Chiang Kai-shek started his little war with China. And I remember by 1949, they had established, he and 1 million of his followers fled to Taiwan. He tried to blow back, to try to fight back against the Chinese government. And they would have nothing to do with it. This is when China was in the process of sliding toward communism, and Chiang Kai-shek was more in favor of authoritarianism, dictatorship with capitalism. And he called that Free China. They went to Taiwan and they set up shop. It was the government was pretty rough. In fact, in 1971, they got expelled from the United Nations. And in 75, he died. His son took over, Shang Ching-kuo. And then in 88, he died. And that was the beginning of democracy in Taiwan. But we've had a relationship with Taiwan basically since the 70s. And they manufacture a lot of goods, and Taiwan is now a fairly democratic nation. And there's this amazing museum, the National Museum. See, when Chiang Kai-shek left China, and this is one of the things that the Chinese are still a little upset about. When he left China, he took a lot of loot with him, a lot of treasure. So much stuff that they've got this huge museum. I mean, you can spend 3 days walking through this thing and not see everything in it. It is one of the largest museums I've ever been in my life. And there is so much stuff back in the mountain, back in the catacombs in the mountain, the loot taken from China, that as I recall, every 3 or 4 months, they change most of the displays in the museum. And so you can go back 3 or 4 times a year and see all brand new stuff, and you still never see everything, all of this stuff, and just exquisite stuff, what they call grain of rice art. It's literally a piece of ivory the size of a grain of rice, and you have to look at it through a giant magnifying glass because on it is carved into it and painted sometimes with several different colors, like several pandas sitting at a table having dinner, or a couple of people having a sword fight. And it's painted on a piece of ivory the size of a grain of rice. And they have these balls of ivory that are carved into concentric circles, one within the other, all carved from the outside. I mean, some of them take 3 or 4 lifetimes to make, where you've got 19 layers of a ball within a ball within a ball within a ball, all made out of one solid piece. And, of course, just extraordinary paintings and calligraphy. And so the Chinese would like some of their treasure back. But anyhow, the Chinese apparently have now come to the conclusion that even though we have been saying for years, and it's obviously one of the things that has caused them to keep their hands off Taiwan, we have been saying that we have a mutual defense pact with Taiwan. The communist Chinese are saying that they're asserting that now that they have the right to take Taiwan by military force. And if Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush had not changed our trade policies in such a way that has thrown us so deeply in debt to communist China that right now communist China could throw our nation into a tailspin economically from which it would take us a generation to recover. All they would have to do is stop buying our debt, stop selling us the strategic things like the missile parts and things that we need to buy from them, stop selling us many of the chips, and start selling all the dollars that they're sitting on, and all the dollar denominated debt instruments, the treasury bonds, treasury bills, things like that. If they just dumped all that stuff on the world market and stopped financing our debt and stopped financing our trade deficit, our trade debt, it would wipe us out. They wouldn't have to fire a shot. And most of this has happened in the last 7 years, the majority of this, thanks to the World Trade Organization, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and the most favored nation status that was pushed by George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, so that they can export products into the United States free of tariff, so that their labor can compete with our labor on a level playing field. So we have created this monster. We have handed them so much power. I was in Beijing in 1987. That's what, 16 years ago, 18 years ago, something like that? I was there in 1987, and I remember standing in Tiananmen Square. There's a major street that goes right along Tiananmen Square. It's huge, like eight lane, 16 lane, something like that, some huge street that goes by the square. It's one of the main arteries. And you could stand on that street and wait for a bus, as I did. I lived there for a month. I was studying acupuncture at the Beijing International Acupuncture Teaching Center and Hospital. It's a big hospital, 500-bed hospital. And, you know, you get around, you take the bus or you take the subway, which was another fascinating experience. But anyhow, you stand out on the street waiting for the bus, and the street was just an ocean of black bicycles. Everybody had a black bicycle, and they were all identical, made by the state, right? And everywhere you went, in Tiananmen Square, for example, there's these long, long rows of places where you could, you know, these bicycle racks, right, where you roll the front wheel in and lock it up. And every now and then, maybe every minute or two, which is a fairly long time, a single car would go by. And that's what it was like in 87. Now I haven't been back since, but I see the newsreels. Now it's like, it looks like New York City. And they're having terrible pollution problems with all the cars and everything. I mean, China has just been developed massively. Why? Because American corporations, multinational corporations, largely based in the United States, have seen fit to move all the jobs from here to there. Not all the jobs, millions of jobs. And very often, one job lost here is two or three jobs created over there. And it's created a boom for the Walton family. They have become billionaires, and George Bush just gave them a huge tax cut where if you make your living off dividend checks, if you make your living sitting around the pool, sitting on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you only pay 15% maximum income tax. Whereas if you work for a living, you can pay up into the 30s. This was the third of Bush's three big tax cuts. And, you know, China has made some billionaires and some millionaires in the United States. And they've just devastated our middle class. And now they're saying to us and to Taiwan, you want to protect Taiwan? Good luck. We've got missiles now. We have bombs. We've tried these missiles. And we're going to pass a law saying that we have the right to take back our colony by force. Let's see how much bluster George W. brings to this one. Here we're talking about a real tyranny, a real dictatorship with real nuclear weapons that's really killing its people every single day. Is he going to stand up to them? Somehow I doubt it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Well, I've been howling in my sleep. I've been starring in my dream. All along this whole time. I've been waiting in the house. I've been waiting on your call. Yeah, it's the Tom Hartman Program where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers. One of the folks in the chat room, were they really locking up bikes in Tiananmen Square? Actually, you know, I have to say, it's been 18 years. I don't remember. It may well be that they didn't. In fact, there seems to be a consensus in the chat room that what it was all about was you leave a bike and you take a bike when you need a bike, and that may well have been the case. Somebody made the comment that I believe it was Amsterdam, you can rent a bike and take it on tours, and these bikes have shown up as far away as Australia, or was it Denmark? Anyhow, bikes, great things. So here, there's an article in today's Wall Street Journal that just reminds me, reminds us all, I would say, or should, of the extraordinary potential that we have lost as the result of Dick Cheney being in charge of the energy policy of the United States. You will recall, of course, after George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were appointed president and vice president by the Supreme Court of the United States in the year 2000, and they came into office in 2001,
And Sandy Berger told Condi Rice, and Al Gore told Dick Cheney, and Bill Clinton told George W. Bush, your number one concern is going to be terrorism, because Al-Qaeda is determined to strike inside the United States. Osama bin Laden is coming after us. And between that time and 9/11, 52 separate alerts were issued to the President of the United States telling him that there was an attack coming inside the United States, spectacular attack. Some of the alerts used the phrase suicide airplane hijackings. Some of them talked about, you know, giant buildings. Some of them talked about skyscrapers. We know all this stuff now. This just came out in the last couple of months after the election, of course. And Dick Cheney, instead of meeting, he was given two responsibilities. One was to be in charge of the anti-terrorism task force, and the other was to be in charge of the energy task force. The anti-terrorism task force, they never got around to meeting before 9/11. How these guys could have let this happen and not be held accountable for it is still beyond me, but that's a whole nother rant. And the energy task force met, was it seven times or nine times? Met a few times with Ken Lay and other members of the oil industry, and Dick Cheney has gone all the way to the Supreme Court to keep us from knowing about it, at the same time that George W. is over there in Russia saying, we got a transparent government in America, all our decisions are open and for all the public to see. Well, anyhow, here's this headline, how retooling lifts U.S. economy despite steep increases in oil prices, by Thaddeus Herrick. And it really reminds us how if we had simply followed Jimmy Carter's advice, and it's still not too late, we're going to have to do it. We're going to be forced into it, in my opinion. But we could have done it voluntarily. If we had simply said the United States is going to be the world leader in renewable energy sources, and therefore we're not going to need to fight wars in the Middle East to protect our oil supply any longer. If we had simply said that, we would have incredible prosperity in the United States. And we'd have 1,500 of our soldiers still alive, 10, 12,000 of them still have their limbs, 50, 60,000 of them not suffering post-traumatic stress disorder and depleted uranium poisoning, and 100,000 Iraqis still alive. Here's the lead paragraph from this article. Though the surging price of oil is nearing a recent high and analysts foresee more increases ahead, increased energy efficiency and a streamlined manufacturing sector are giving the U.S. economy surprising resiliency. Well, that's just the rational, reasonable amount of fuel savings, insulation of buildings, making more fuel-efficient devices, pretty much everything except passenger cars and SUVs. We'll still give Arnold a $100,000 tax deduction if he wants to buy a Hummer, or anybody else who owns a small business. $100,000 tax deduction for an SUV. It's got to weigh more than 6,000 pounds for you to get that tax deduction. But we could have done it. We could have done it. We could be the world's leader. Now China's going to. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You're the lucky one, so I've been told. It's free as a wind blowing down the road. Loved by many, hated by none. I'd say you were lucky because I know what you've done. Not a care in the world, not a worry in sight. Everything's going to be all right. You're the lucky one.
Oh, what nice music. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Here, it just continues. It just continues. India, this from the Wall Street Journal today. India, now keep in mind, our oil dependence, our addiction to foreign oil, has led us into wars in the Middle East, into an absolute hyperactive Middle Eastern policy. I mean, we've been propping up dictatorships in the Middle East, propping up the Saudi dictatorship, propping up the Jordanian dictatorship, propping up, helping prop up the Qatari and the Omani and the UAE dictatorships. the Egyptian dictatorship of Mubarak, the Pakistani dictatorship of Musharraf. Although we're not getting oil out of Pakistan, but, you know, trying to just, it's in the region, more or less. Now they've got nukes. I mean, you know, we've got a. And now, and a good chunk of our oil comes from Venezuela. And we've got Hugo Chavez now, the president of Venezuela, who we acknowledge we've played dirty tricks on. We tried to help him get overthrown when there was a coup. They kicked him out of office for a few days. Bush congratulated the leaders of the coup. Then Chavez comes back into office. Chavez now is running around saying he's got proof that George W. is trying to get him assassinated. The duly elected president of Venezuela. It turns out Venezuela is one of the countries that exports enormous quantities of oil, and they supply a large chunk of oil to the United States. In fact, we're their largest customer, and they supply, I forget the percent, I think it's around 10 or 12% of our oil. It's some very significant portion of our oil. And so now we have the situation where India, which is growing like crazy, and you know why India is like growing like crazy? Because of our insane trade policies that have moved all our jobs over there. So Microsoft is going on a hiring binge. Last time I was in India, Microsoft was holding a jobs fair in Bangalore. No, in Madras. And they said they were going to hire something like 50,000 people, is my recollection. I could be wrong. It might have been 10,000. Whatever it was thousands, tens of thousands. And people from all over India were coming there to get a job with Microsoft. You can hire an engineer with a master's degree over there, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 a year. Or at least you could a few years ago. So India is growing like crazy. As we export our blue-collar jobs to China and our white-collar jobs to India, and growing like crazy, they need more oil. So where are they getting their oil? Well, they're starting to cut deals with the Russians. They're starting to cut deals with the folks in the former Soviet republics, the Baltic states, the area around the Balkans. They're cutting deals with the Middle East, of course. They're buying Middle Eastern oil. You wonder why, you know, the price of oil is up $53 a barrel, and everybody's saying it's not going to go below 50 again. And I said on this program 6 months ago, by the end of this year, by the end of 2000, it'll be at $100 a barrel. As George W. would say, $100 a barrel. And I still stand by that. I expect it to be $80 a barrel by the end of the summer. Why? Because India and China are growing like crazy, and they're consuming mind-boggling quantities of oil. 40% of the mercury pollution that's hitting the United States now is coming from China. And India is cranking it up like crazy. So here now in today's Wall Street Journal, a small story. This should be a screaming headline in every newspaper in America. It's time for us to wake up. We have to realize the mess that the Bush administration, and not just the Bush administration, that the Clinton trade policies and the Bush senior trade policies and the Reagan trade policies have put us in. Here we have four successive presidencies over 20-some-odd years that have put us at the mercy of these other nations and hollowed out the middle class in the United States. And the headline reads, India signs oil production deal with Venezuela. India's way over there. Venezuela's here in the Western Hemisphere. India's, you know, the subcontinent of Asia. That's a long way to haul oil. India clinched a deal to operate an oil field in Venezuela, importing its output as the two countries vowed to strengthen ties, officials said. And they go through this whole thing. India consumed 2.46 million barrels of oil a day in 2004 and is expected to use 2.53 million barrels a day this year. The country is likely to import 85% of its consumption in the next two decades to compete with China for foreign oil projects. Venezuela ships more than half of its daily output to the U.S., but Mr. Chavez, a strong critic of Washington, has made clear he wants to diversify his country's overseas energy ties to reduce its economic dependence on the American market. And in the process, stick it to the American administration. And who's going to pay the price? You and me. And hopefully, I mean, you know, there may be a silver lining in this. The silver lining would be if energy prices go up enough in the United States, then you will see the emergence of an energy-efficient industry, you know, solar power industry, wind power industry, geothermal industry, industry to further insulate homes, retrofit them, all that stuff that people were doing during Jimmy Carter's administration because he was giving tax breaks for it. You're going to see the emergence of it simply because when Carter was president, oil was $8 a barrel, and now it's 50. Although, frankly, I think that it's going to have to go to $80 or $90 a barrel before we start seeing really significant changes in the behavior of Americans. Europeans have already figured it out. I mean, you've got a little Denmark over there. Or is it Finland? No, it's Denmark. Copenhagen, Denmark. You got Denmark over there generating some 18-19% of their energy from windmills off the coast of Copenhagen. As I recall, hopefully my geography is right. Rich in Boulder, Colorado on the line. 1-866, by the way, our toll-free number if you'd like to get in on the conversation. 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I'm living out of Boulder, Colorado. I've been here about 8 years. I moved here from a suburb of Detroit, Wayne, Michigan. And like I said, I've been out here 8 years. And when I moved out here, I decided that I was going to get rid of my car.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And I've been car-free for 8 years now.
Wow.
And I think there's a term back in the 60s that was coined, the personal is political.
Yes.
And every action that we take is, you know, has political ramifications. And at the core, I'm an environmentalist. And, you know, I came to the realization that the corporations are not going to take care of the problems of energy and all this kind of stuff. It's up to us as individuals to do something about it. And as far as getting off the car, I see it as central to so many problems, you know, rampant consumerism, the obesity epidemic, the diabetes epidemic, sprawl, et cetera. I mean,
yeah, we have redesigned our way of life around suburbs, and suburbs are not sustainable communities by
right.
and large. I mean, by and large, you don't find the place to work, the place to shop, and the natural resources that you would need, particularly in hard times, in a suburban community. You just don't. They depend entirely on cars, or increasingly in some cases on mass transit. I mean, there are some of the older suburbs around, for example, Boston and New York. You can actually exist without a car, but in any case, as you were saying.
Well, yeah, and Boulder is one of the leading, you know, the best places to bike in the country. But, you know, we as progressives, we need to decide if we're going to live the rest of our lives in automobiles or if we're going to take a stand and, you know, get off that. You know, if you need to drive to work, well, make sure you live close to your work so you can walk or bike or bus or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
The corporations and the government aren't going to do this for us. It's up to us. And I think there really needs to be a movement around this, you know.
I agree.
And I do a lot of that.
I agree.
And,
although you know, Rich, at some point, there is two points. Number one, there's a lot to be said for we the people getting together and saying we would like to provide us with incentives for this kind of behavior. And traditionally, the way that you do that is with a tax code. For example, we give people incentives to own homes. They get to deduct from their income taxes the interest that they pay to the bank.
Right.
It's really a subsidy to banks and to homeowners. And
mm-hmm.
and it's because we want people to own their own homes. There's a social benefit to it. And
mm-hmm.
there's no shortage of those. I mean, the tax code is you know, 8 feet tall because the vast majority of these tax variations or changes or loopholes or whatever are justified as producing some sort of social good, although most of them are corporate social goods, arguably. But number one, I think that we the people should do that. And number two, there are market forces at work. And as oil goes up, I mean, it's not like we're just going to suddenly run out of oil tomorrow morning and everything's going to freak out and change. I mean, I wrote the book, right, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about the end of oil, about what, you know, life will be like at the end of oil. And right. yet what's going to happen is that it will be a gradual thing. It's just the question is, by gradual, I mean, you know, over a 10, 15, 20, 30-year period rather than a one-year period. But the question is it going to be a gradual, positive, wonderful, moving into a better world thing? Or is it going to be a gradual disaster, painful, you know, screeching halt, diminishing America's stature in the world, wiping out our standard of living, you know, fouling our air kind of thing? And Jimmy Carter was moving us in the let's make it a positive direction. And Reagan and Bush and Reagan are moving us and Bush rather, Reagan, Bush and Bush are moving us in the direction of let's run up, smack right into the wall, bang, get a bloody nose and go, oh, I guess we got to change things.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be that way. It's like here in Boulder, like I said, it's one of the best places in the country to get around by bike.
Why is that? Because, why is that?
Well, because 30 years ago, folks in this town started, you know, going to city council meetings and reviewing the transportation master plan that every city has, and they said, hey, we want bike facilities, and the city listened, and, you know, that's what it's going to take.
So there's like bike paths along every street, and there's places to tie up your bicycle or whatever you call it.
Yep.
I guess you tie up a horse. What do you do with a bicycle? Park it?
Yeah, and lock it to a rack and yeah. whatnot. But yeah, if the facilities are there, people are going to ride on them and use them.
Yeah, you know? I'm totally with you. When Louise and I moved out of the woods 6 years ago and moved into town here, we have a no car policy. We live four blocks from the center of the town that we live in Montpelier, Vermont. And and we just walk wherever we go. I mean, it's I feel great. It's good exercise. In fact, our house is on a hill. I get out of breath walking up to the house, and I think it's good for me.
Yeah, and this kind of ties into what you've talked about before about individuals only being able to maintain 150 relations with other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keeping our lives small. You know, we don't need to drive all over the place having all these relations. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think it's more in tune with the human nature and what we are.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Rich, I salute you. Thank you for calling, and thanks for sharing that story with us, and thanks for being one of us who has decided to take personal responsibility more so than others. May many people emulate your extraordinary example. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line, our number 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I enjoyed listening to Rich. I'm kind of on the other end of that. I live way out in Tule's. And 30 years ago when I made the decision to buy out there, that was a wonderful lifestyle deal. I was traveling a lot, so it didn't matter where I lived. I wasn't commuting. I just drive to the airport and go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things have changed.
It's a lot different now.
things have changed a lot, yeah. And I suspect that these changing patterns, and particularly the price of oil, is going to have a lot of unintended consequences. You're going to see housing values in suburbs that are only...
It is bothering me because we are in one of the, quote, yuppie, you know, I mean, this is Santa Fe downscale. This is where all of the... folks are cashing out of their California homes and coming and buying, and our real estate is just going crazy. You know, and quite frankly, I was kind of expecting a little of that for my retirement. Well, blow that. Kind of like along with my 401 or 201 or...
Yeah, 401k.
Whatever. Actually, the reason that I called, though, Tom, was earlier you were talking about getting a hold of your congressmen and senators and whatnot, and I just had to pass on a success story.
Okay.
I called Bingaman, Senator Bingaman, here in New Mexico about a week or so ago when they wrote, there was some of the senators that wrote an letter to the president demanding they explain the how Gannon was able to get in the press room.
Right.
And I called Bingaman's office to say, why didn't he sign that?
Uh-huh.
Well, yesterday I got a call back from one of his administrative assistants in Washington, and it so happened I was forwarded my cell phone. And I was in a friend of mine's tailor shop, and her and her grown daughter and another adult that works for her, and a customer heard me talking. I ended up passing the phone around to all four of them.
That's great.
So when they call me to get clarified on what was I talking about and this and that, yada, yada, and then I got on the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah.
And we had just been talking about that there in Hayes' store. And so I said, hey, wait a second. I'm not only by myself. You got your pad and pencil handy. I need to pass you on to these folks.
Here's some more of your constituents. Here's some more of your constituents. That's great.
So
that is great.
It just snowballed. And that's the whole thing that I mentioned yesterday. We've just got to keep creating this virus.
Yeah.
Just get it out there.
It's
and
thought
get,
virus.
Get it in the stream and get people active. Those four women, that was the first time they had ever talked to a congressional office.
Yeah, that's remarkable. That's
and
remarkable.
I think it was fun.
Yeah. Well, you've done good, Roy. I congratulate you. And
so,
keep up
anyway,
the great work.
Just tell everybody, get out here and just agitate. Like Hightower says, agitate and educate.
There you go. And the phone number for and thank you for the call, Roy. And the phone number for Congress, for your senator or your member of the House of Representatives, 202-224-3121. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I will make it through here in the United States. I have tremendous hope. We have a 230-year history of holding to the ideals of democracy. We're not going to let these right-wing cranks drag us down. We really are not going to allow it to happen. The American people are saying right now, in so many different ways, don't mess with our Social Security, don't ruin our Medicare, don't make our air dirtier, don't make our water more poisonous. Stop selling out to these huge multinational corporations. Come on, we'd like our democracy back, Mr. Bush. Helen in West Virginia on the line. Hey, Helen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Howdy.
Well, I wanted to ask if you've read the book Senator Byrd wrote, Losing America.
I have not. Should I?
I beg you to.
Okay. Did it just recently come out?
Everyone out there, the paper copy will be coming out at the end of the month.
Okay.
And that will be a little bit less expensive. And,
right.
But particularly one chapter called Out of Business. Senator Byrd is one of the most studied men in our history.
I believe he's one of the most brilliant men in the United States Senate. I know Rush Limbaugh loves to make fun of him because when he was a teenager, he was involved with the KKK.
We
have all made mistakes in our lives.
That has been the most heart-rending thing that he's had to go through, and yet he holds his head up high, and he's fighting for the democracy of this country, and he loves this country.
Yeah.
But this book is something else, and I urge everyone to get a copy of it and read it. And because he explains about the war, he confronts Rumsfeld in it and about knowing about the chemicals and the weapons and everything. Mm. And until we saw that on TV where Rumsfeld was shaking hands with Saddam, it was just words, but when we saw that, was seeing was believing, and he couldn't get over someone had captured that on TV. So we all saw that.
What you're referring to, Helen, just for our listeners who may not know what you're talking about, back in during the Bush during the Reagan Bush administration,
right?
Don Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense again?
Yes.
Yeah, as I recall. And he went over to Iraq, and about a month after Saddam gassed the Kurds,
right,
was videotaped shaking hands with Saddam Hussein and embracing him. And Hussein was our good friend, and we sold him the gas he used on the Kurds.
Absolutely.
And and nobody was upset about it in the Reagan or Bush administrations. It was just fine. I mean, he was, hey, do what you got to do. Just keep selling us oil.
Well, Senator Byrd mentions this. He leads up to all of what we've been through.
Mm-hmm.
He tells us a lot about history, about his travels overseas when he was a younger man.
Uh-huh.
And he is one of the best, and we should listen to him and heed his warnings. Yeah. As he voted against the war.
He was one of the few. He's maybe the only one.
I called the office up there. I talked with his secretary. I wanted to know the 23 that stood against this war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not told, but it's in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I urge you to read it, please.
I will look for it. In fact, I do a book review every month for BuzzFlash.com, and it sounds like it would make a great review for next month's book. What is the title of it again, Helen?
Losing America.
Losing America by Senator Robert Byrd. Okay,
yes.
I will check it out, Helen, I promise you.
Thank you,
for the call, and thanks for waking me up and all the rest of us. I do appreciate
you, dear.
It. Keep up the great work there, Helen, and spread the good word. It's Tom Hartman here with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Once again, telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. And so you won't see on the evening news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.